Meeting. I know there are one or two changes of personnel, and so welcome to those who haven't been before. Peter Jones, Anne Hobbs. Are you subs? Oh yes, you're subbing for. And Frank, James. Is anybody else? Thank you very much. So welcome to all of you, welcome to the attendees who aren't on the committee as well. Our first item is minutes. Has anybody got any objection to me signing the minutes? Apologies.
Thank you, Chairman. Apologies from Councillor Dee McNaughton, who is substituted tonight by Councillor Anne Hobbs, and also apologies from Councillor Brenda McEwen, who's not appointed a substitute.
Thank you. And public question time, nil. Councillor Session, nil. Members' items, nil. Called in items, nil. Which takes us straight to the first officer's report, which is the external review of the planning service. And we have got online, hopefully. Now, a report was produced which you've seen in the papers, but what's the service called, Dean? Our consultants.
Oh, Mondrum.
Mondrum, that's right, by Mondrum. And Lucy Gibbs is going to present to us the outline of the report and the findings that took place that are being implemented by the service as we speak. We hope. It's gone off now.
I'll invite her again. She has accepted the invite.
Is that in the
waiting room?
Waiting room.
Oh, well done, Lucy. Can you hear us, Lucy? We can't hear you. Oh, yes, we can hear you. Very welcome. Thank you for coming to the scrutiny committee and presenting to us. We'll let you fire ahead, please.
We can see you.
Can everybody hear?
I can do it a little bit louder.
You need to make it a bit louder.
Yeah, that's better.
I mean, I can talk louder. Like.
That's fine. Okay, that's fine now.
Great. Okay. So if I share these slides, is this this going to work? Let's see.
Yep.
Oh, sorry. Wrong thing. Sorry, just 2 seconds. You can spot them on the road. Sorry about this, everybody. Okay, I'm just going to show.
She's on the road.
She's not literally on the road.
Okay, I'm going to share my screen, I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. Is that all right? Can you see
that's
it now?
That's right, we can see it now, thank you.
Right, Wait, okay. I won't be able to see you, so you'll have to chime in if there's something you want to ask me, okay. So we're just here to give you an update on
Lucy, yeah? Could you just put it on full screen for us?
Let's just go in a bit more. If I do that, I will be able to see my notes. For some reason, I wouldn't find it on the
interview. Go back to...
So that's as big as I can make it.
That's fine. Okay.
So I'm just here to give you an update on the external review that's been taking place at the planning service and what's happened so far and what's come next. So, from November to January, November last year to January this year, we reviewed the planning service to see if it was fit for purpose and what needs to happen to make it better into the future. The full report is available on the council's website now of that review. The planning service really did take ownership of the issues that they were facing around service delivery, including doing quite a lot of work to understand what their root causes were. Principally, there were some cultural issues, there was a backlog of planning applications in the system, and the approach to planning was at the heart of those root causes. So you can see all of the detail of all of that in the full report that's available through the website. And I'm sure if you haven't got a link to that, we can make one available to you. Based on what we fed back to the team, they worked on some objectives and developed that through to a service plan and an action plan, which is sort of what you can see as the background image to this slide here. So that's a list of things that need to happen, who's going to do them, and when they're going to happen as well, and the Gantt chart there. They are making really good progress along that plan. The plan is going to run until around November time this year, and the work includes lots of responsibilities, backlog reduction, so caseload reduction work, work with statutory consultees, and work to address the cultural issues within the service, principally working in silos, so trying to break those silos down between the planning service and other parts of the council. And so the progress that's been made so far is principally around caseload reduction. So the initial focus of this project is to reduce work in progress, that's undecided planning applications, by increasing productivity, which is decisions per person per day, to release the team from the failure demands that they were spending a lot of their time on. So they were very, very busy, but servicing the failure demands associated with high levels of work in progress. This orange wiggly line on this slide here represents undecided planning applications from the beginning of 2023 to today. You can see obviously that the team made a huge dent in their backlog planning applications, but then that progress has sort of stalled between 450 and 500 applications, rising to about 600 at one point there towards the end of 2024. It has been coming down slowly since then, but actually we're entered into a period of shortened for management caseloads, where every single planner develops an individual work plan. They then meet every day to see if they manage to do what they were planning to do or not, and the focus is on getting quick wins out of the door, so anything that can be decided that day does get decided, no matter when it was received. They're always a priority, and then everything else comes afterwards. That work has been started about 5 weeks ago, and the initial outcome is that productivity has doubled by that priority approach that I've just spoken about, prioritising things that can be done quickly and doing them as quickly as possible. So productivity has been around 0.5, 0.6 decisions per person per day, where the previous long-term average was 0.27 over this last year here. During this period, so that's just from having the new approach to planning, and as well the team are fixing the issues that are slowing them down. So there's some issues with delayed consultee responses, there's some issues with assessing applications that don't have all of the required information with them, so that's that's what's happening at the moment, and we fully expect productivity to increase. But if the team carried on at 2.5 and 0.6 productivity, then they will reach a healthy workload by the end of October. So that represents 5 weeks worth of work in around 130 applications in the system. As the work goes to fix the issues that are depressing productivity, you might expect to get there a bit quicker. There is a slight complication, or not a slight complication, there's what's not shown on here is that there was a delay of validation. There remains a delay with the validation team, but they've started shortening to management too and are actually passing more of the applications through to planners more quickly. And so while it looks like work in progress hasn't dropped any significant amount in the last couple of weeks here, actually what's happening is that the backlog in validation is being cleared just as quickly as the backlog in determination is being cleared up to. So we'll soon get to the point where planners get their hands on applications a lot more quickly. And so you will expect to see this trajectory coming along, even though you might say, oh, well, actually the last couple of weeks it looks like, if anything, work in progress has gone up very slightly. The point is that we want customers to notice a better service. So we expect that to happen sometime around sort of September time, if not before. Depending on how the work goes to fix the issues that are depressing productivity, including with statutory consultees, then you might see that even more quickly. So that's the work that the team are doing, and they've picked it up probably the quickest I've seen anybody ever pick it up. And the fact that they've doubled productivity just in the first 5 weeks alone is quite remarkable. This brings me on to pre-application advice. So at the same time as reducing their caseload, the team have worked up a new approach to delivering pre-application advice, including gathering input from statutory consultees where appropriate, to be able to give timely, robust and reliable advice to applicants with the viability of the scheme considered, along with all of the impacts and obligations that the developer might have. That service, that we fully expect to have that switched on and available to customers and marketed to them by the end of the month for almost all types of applications. Again, that work is going well, and the team are quite excited to turn that service fully on to anybody who wants to go to the council for pre-application advice. And I know that the customers have asked for it too. We've spoken to some customers at the agents forum, and they've told us how supportive they are of having pre-application advice made available to them. So the team do need some space to be able to do this work. We've worked with the customer services team to give them a bit of a shield from the failure demand that have been caused by high levels of work in progress, so that they can have time to redesign the approach to pre-application advice and really focus on getting all of the decisions out of the door that can be. You can help by encouraging anybody who wants to track progress on an application to use the public access portal to do that, and you can also do that by responding to collaboration requests when we're asking for to redesign new ways of working. It's really essential that we get input from all of the different people that are going to be affected by those changes. Very soon we're going to be proposing a new way to charge for applications that are received, vetted, and then found to be invalid, and the information required not being submitted, so that we can make sure that there's space in the budget to do that work for people. It is really valuable to do vetting and say why what an application needs to be done to be made valid, so we want to protect the office time to be able to keep doing that. There might be other things as well coming down the line when they start doing process redesign. So that's where we are right now. Is there any questions? I'm going to stop sharing so that I can see all of you again, and then if there's any questions anybody's got, or you want any more detail about anything, then I'll be happy to share that.
Thank you.
Any questions, anyone? Oh, Doug.
So the pre-application and planning performance agreements is kind of put in as a kind of project. Forgive me my ignorance. That sounds like where we currently have a workload problem, adding more workload. Could you take us through how those decrease workload?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea is that developers, customers will get a sort of go, no-go decision on the site a lot earlier on in the process. And it is usually quicker to provide pre-application advice than it is to assess a full application, and it actually speeds up the processing of those applications once the authority receives them, assuming everybody sticks to what's been advised or agreed at that pre-application advice, through that pre-application advice process. So actually it does speed up productivity of the decisions when they come. So that's the sort of element of it. Plus, because it's being paid for, the services can protect the resources needed to service that work.
Thank you.
It is a bit of a tricky situation when you've still got a backlog of current planning applications and you're also asking for new pre-application advice requests. I do understand that. That's why the team needs a little bit of space in the short term to be able to focus on the work that's coming through. And there is an option for getting some short-term resources in to service that extra demand as well. So it might be a bit bumpy in the middle of doing that, but actually once you've got a really great pre-app offering on the go, typically we see planning services having much quicker productivity on their applications workloads, and so actually you have got plenty of time in planners' lives to be able to service that work.
Thank you.
Would it make any difference in productivity if we had the staff back in the office? I find as a councillor in the past, I used to be able to go into the office, speak to the appropriate officer. Now, if you go in, you've maybe got one person in the office. And trying to contact the appropriate officer is a pain in the whatever.
So I think there's a conflation of issues there. Number one is the availability of planning officers to have those informal conversations with interested parties, let's say, that can smooth the wheels of planning, and that absolutely, as a separate issue, would be made easier if there was everybody sharing the same physical location all the time. As in terms of speeding up productivity on planning decisions, there has been no studies done so far, and actually I don't know any authority in the country that's sent their staff back to work full time. There's a trial, so it's difficult to gather the data on whether that would or wouldn't be. There's no reason why you couldn't do a trial. The reason that you might not choose to do that would be that if planning officers value being able to work from flexible locations, there is a dearth of qualified, experienced planners in the marketplace, and so they might choose to go and work somewhere where that flexibility is still offered. So there's pros and cons to both sides, but I can't tell you definitively if it would speed up productivity by having everybody back in the same physical location. I can tell you that the communication overheads reduce when you do share a space like that. But those communication overheads can be managed in digital ways these days. It's just whether or not those digital processes and systems are in place. I've just lost a picture of can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yeah,
great, okay.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'd like to ask a little bit more about the pre-application sort of system that you're going to be putting in. How exactly is that going to be working? Is that going to be someone on the end of a telephone? Is it going to be a database? Is it going to be a portal that people can access? And what sort of ideas on the cost of it from the people in sort of our community who have no experience of planning applications. It's going to be a fundamental and a very, very useful tool for them, but obviously we don't want them getting put off if they've got to put a, if there's going to be a high price or it's going to be long-winded. What sort of ideas have you got around that, and also sort of ideas of what the revenue stream would be?
Okay, so the charging schedule has already been voted through and is you know been adopted by the council. I'm just going to grab that up on screen in just 2 seconds. Sorry. So for household applications or adverts, it's £60 plus you can pay £40 for an additional clarification meeting. And that ranges all the way through to that. There's different levels of charging for, you know, residential that's one to four dwellings. That starts around £250 with £100 extra, and there's going to be extra charges for specialist county council advice as well from £89 an hour, and then all the way up to major and complex, which is starting at £4,000. So that charging schedule has already been agreed by the council. It's just about the design of it now. So the idea is that pre-application advice will be asked for in writing, and that the main response will be a written one. However, there is some flexibility there, so that officers can provide case-specific views, not just policy citations, and there's always an option for a meeting as well. So that's the sort of approach that we are proposing at the moment. It's the team is still working on it, so it's nothing set in stone yet, but those are the sort of principles behind it. Does that answer your question enough?
A little bit.
Would there, a bit more detail that would, you want to give.
Would there be any sort of clear guidelines to the sort of layman person who just wants to extend their downstairs privy with what exactly they need to do? Because this is something that's been fed back to me, some of the people in my ward, they just don't know where to start, and they don't want to start and have to go out and start paying for this legal advice.
Yeah. Well, I would strongly recommend, you know, for households, people that don't put together planning applications regularly, definitely go in for pre-application advice. I mean, even if you did pay for the optional additional meeting, it's £100 from start to finish. And it's probably money well spent, because it will really help you to put together an application with all of the, you know, help you to engage with a validation checklist as well. So absolutely, you've got all the information you need to be able to put together a planning application. You know, the team are human beings, and they do understand that some people do this once in a lifetime, and, you know, the team there are more, you know, they're willing to help people to put together an application that's accessible. Pre-application advice would be a great place to start with that, because, you know, on a duty phone that's there at the moment, the officer can't give case-specific advice. It's general policy citations, which is not usually much use to the man on the street. Absolutely, having that pre-application advice I think is going to be really helpful. The revenue stream, not sure about yet. It depends on, obviously, the take-up of it. Based on what everybody's been telling me, I expect it to be pretty high, the demand for it, and, you know, that's good for the council, that's good for the residents, that's good for the businesses in the borough. There's likely to be a landing phase where the team get used to doing this work, and it's appropriately resourced, and it's one of those, you're not really sure until you open the door how many people are going to come and ask for it. So it's not easy to forecast at this stage, because it is a new offering, but we're pretty hopeful that there'll be plenty of demand for the service, and, as you know, very quickly within the first few weeks we should be able to put together some forecasts and make sure that the resources are in place to service it, and that we've got the revenue stream coming in, and it's all budgeted for.
Thank you.
You were asking a question.
No, I was just going to come.
Oh, you are answering.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, just to add to what Lucy said, we did take a report through to Cabinet back in December, which Cabinet agreed the proposed charging scheme for pre-application that's been incorporated into our sort of fees and charges. So John's at the back of the room. So John did a bit of research into what other local planning authorities were charging in terms of pre-application. We did some benchmarking, John. We looked around and I think we were comfortable that what we were proposing was fair, was reasonable, and wasn't going to be prohibitively high compared to other areas. So we can circulate again to the committee that charging schedule which has been agreed. As Lucy has said, what the team have been doing is just working through the process notes, how we're going to introduce it, how we're going to market it, and how we're going to resource it, linking it into the improvement project. We have engaged with the agents, well, planning agents who regularly do business with the council and submit applications on behalf of many of the people that you mentioned. All of the agents have said to us they want pre-app introduced as soon as possible. They're willing to pay for it. They see it as valuable, and we've made that commitment. So we're very keen to introduce it. We're working the detail through at the moment, and hopefully we'll have that ready to launch by the end of the month. But all of the approvals that we need to introduce that have been given to us. As I say, it's just getting the team ready for it. But we can circulate that report again for the committee.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, then.
In the report, figure one on page 12 of the report, it introduces, certainly introduces us to a measure, a data measure that we've not seen in this committee previously of decisions per person per day. So the first thing is, I think that gives some of the data we've been looking at in terms of the backlog a different dimension, which I think is really useful for us to understand. So kind of commending that as a piece of information that we get reported, it gives us a useful kind of value. The other side of it is kind of, as soon as you start measuring something, people try and achieve it. That's kind of in human nature. What can we be doing in order to ensure that if we are measuring how, essentially we're measuring how quickly decisions are made or how many decisions are made within a time period, so they end up being the same thing. Mm-hmm. How can we ensure that those decisions are quality decisions? And ensure that we have systems in place for that, because obviously decisions in this context need to be quality decisions. And the other side of it is there a plan of ensuring that there's a kind of data through line here? As a really good example, if we're to ensure that the pre-application process does give us value for money, then the applications that have been through the pre-application process should also be ones that are done in a timely fashion. Yeah, so making sure that we have a data through line for that to ensure that we can say, actually, yep, we can see that, one, things that have been through pre-app are going through more in a more timely fashion, and also that ones that we're not in, that there isn't an increase in appeals, kind of just raw appeals numbers, mm-hmm, but also appeals that are found against us.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the first point about productivity and going more quickly, it introduced the risk that people will be target driven and, you know, at the cost of quality. There is no way of apart from, you know, appeals upheld, that you can measure the sort of quality of decisions. You know, you have to trust at some point that you've got dedicated professionals who know how to do a good job. Now, when we started measuring productivity, there was no increase in productivity for the first few months. When we've introduced shortened time management and caseloads, we've been very, very careful not to make it target driven. So each individual officer has their own individual work plan, and they're asked to do a reasonable, realistic level of throughput and forecast what that's going to be for the next 2 weeks, each day, how many decisions they think they can make, whether that's delegated or going to committee. It's sent to sign off, had all of the appropriate checks with specialist advisors, you know, statutory consultees and the like, and then they put it in their plan on the day they think that's going to be able to be made. We're really, really careful to not have those be target driven. That's an expected level of throughput. Working as quickly as you can on the quick things, and with everything in mind for you that, you know, your system's working well and your process is working well, that's it. And so actually there's no, at this stage, we're not introducing any changes to the quality standards that the officers have previously been working towards. So actually this doesn't require fear. Doing this work doesn't require any change to the quality standards. They are upheld as they always have been. And when we do this work, it doesn't, you know, it never has. In the 30 odd times we've done it, it's never resulted in poorer quality decisions being made. The big thing is that the things that depress productivity often go unnoticed because they're not being measured. And once you understand them as things that artificially slow people down, it's nothing to do with the quality of the work at all, it's just that systems and processes are not working well together because it's the oversight and seeing how all the bits of that system and how all the bits of that process actually join up. Once you get the team focused on that, that's where the productivity gains come in. It's not from suspending any sort of quality standards or introducing any new regulations or legislation or anything like that. It's entirely separate to quality standards. I've never seen that, and I'd be very shocked if it was the case at Stafford. So, you know, that's the evidence I can give you. The proof of the pudding will obviously be in the eating. If you do get more, if the decisions you're making are less defendable and more appealable, then that's going to be a problem. But from what I've seen from the team so far, that's not an issue, and nobody's asked them to rush at things. You know, it's carry on doing what you're doing and just focus on anything that can be done quickly, you do that quickly first. So things like discharging conditions, things like, you know, if people are sending in non-material amendments, sorry if I'm going into technical jargon, but there's small bits of planning that can be done quickly, and it's focusing on them, you know, the more transactional nature things. And then if you can get those through as quickly as possible, actually you've got more time to spend on the things that you need to have more attention on, because you're not spending time responding to progress chases, you're not spending time on fighting appeals on grounds of non-determination, and you're not responding to complaints because things haven't been done quickly enough. People for whom applications are sensitive and complex, they do understand that they might need to grant an extension of time, and they do understand that there's going to be a certain amount of dialogue between the case officer, the applicant, the statutory consultees. So for those cases, you know, absolutely, they do need more time to be done properly. It's about doing the quick stuff as quickly as possible, which doesn't affect some of the, you know, quality standards at all. I'm really sorry. I've tried to jot down the point you're making on pre-application advice, the question you had on pre-application advice, and all I've put down is pre-application advice. I'm really, really sorry about that. Could you just repeat that bit of the question for me?
Yeah, it's about making sure that the data collection process separates those two out. So applications that have had pre-application advice, that gives an indication of value for money on the pre-application process to ensure that it's doing what we expect it to.
Yeah, so towards, you'll appreciate we're not doing all of this all at once, we're trying to do it all in the right order, this work. So there's a new performance dashboard that we'll be working on probably September time that will include, you know, KPIs associated with the new pre-app advice. So it'll be on what we call the measures that matter. So staff wellbeing, customer satisfaction, which isn't being measured at the moment in any sort of robust way other than complaints, you know. And also, percentage of applications that have had pre-application advice delivered on them. You know, you're already measuring appeals, obviously you'll continue to do that. You'll also measure the applications determined within the 8 and 13 week time scales, which, you know, that's a statutory national measure. But we'll be adding in new measures, and yeah, absolutely, the performance on pre-applications and things like average time to determine and average time to validate as well. We'll be looking at those too, and of course your work in progress and your productivity, which are new measures as well. So putting all of those into a performance dashboard that's ideally built through Power BI, something that can automate the data flows, putting them in a place on SharePoint where the team have got access to it, so nothing's sort of hidden or mysterious about performance. That's part of this project, but it's going to come towards the end of the work, so yeah, September, maybe October, depending on how everything else goes. But yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Okay.
Greg. Thanks, Chair. Just in terms of a nice overview of that, as an appendix four sort of project charter, as Lucy said, there'll be performance dashboards and more detailed and technical things, but just in terms of for today and an easy read document, that gives an indication of the directions and the stuff that we'll be looking at, which hopefully addresses a couple of your points.
Thank you. Can I just raise one question with you? That's the question of enforcement. Was it on your programme to look at enforcement? I think it was. And what were your conclusions? Because it seems to be an outstanding and major issue at the moment within the service.
Yeah. At the moment, the team are working on a new enforcement policy. So looking at including things like harm scoring and experiences scoring to make it much more clear what enforcements do, what they don't, what they can't investigate, and you know how you can manage that service in a better way. So that's with Lucy MacDonald's now working across Cannock and Stafford. She's built a new
just explain who Lucy. Sorry,
and obviously we've got a backlog of cases to investigate as well, as you know. So they're working through those new cases and reviewing this new policy. And I'll come back to you really soon on progress they've made on, you know, on that, and a proposal of how they're going to move forward with the service. So it's in flux at the moment, and I just don't have an update right now.
Okay, thank you. Dean, you're going to come back on.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just that Lucy was in full flow there. So, Lucy MacDonald is enforcement officer who is employed by Cannock Chase Council, but we are sharing that resource at the moment with Stafford Council. We have three agency enforcement officers. We brought some new officers into the team very recently, very experienced, and they're looking at prioritising their caseload and working through the backlog. As Lucy indicated, we're reviewing the enforcement policy and protocols. We're also working with other service areas, regulatory services, community safety, on a kind of multidisciplinary team approach as well, particularly for complex cases where multiple teams are involved and we're using different powers. It's not just planning enforcement powers, it could be community safety, it could be others. That team is being formed at the moment. It won't bring any new resource or power, but it is about the team working together, and it's really about communication. That work is being headed up by Gabrielle Whitehouse, who's head of regulatory services, obviously involved in that with colleagues as well. And we do expect that there would be a very small number of cases who will fit into that kind of sort of territory, really. So we are looking at enforcement. One of the challenges we do have is recruiting enforcement officers. There's a national shortage. We've got agency staff in, as I said, at the moment. We'd like ideally to have experienced permanent staff working within the team. We are reviewing the job descriptions of those roles at the moment, and we will be looking to go out and advertise those roles, but it is a really, really difficult area to recruit to, very difficult to get experienced people in, and a lot of those officers now are working as agency staff. So it is an issue, but we are going to review it. We're going to look at our policy, and I think, Chair, the suggestion is certainly one we can bring back to committee in the future, because I think whilst our focus quite rightly has been on development management and getting applications through and reducing the backlog, we do have enforcement as a priority as well. So I think probably one to bring back to a future meeting with more detail whilst the development management improvement project is kind of being delivered.
Thank you very much for that. Any more questions for Lucy? Lucy, thank you very much indeed for the part you have played and the explanations you've given. I gather that you're here for some while to come, so we'll be watching with interest what progress is made. And
thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Okay, bye. In that context, and given what Dina said, I just wondered, I had put down that we have a look again at this, the whole of the working that's taking place at the October meeting, if that's not too soon, and perhaps pick up enforcement at that meeting as well. Does that seem to be a reasonable timetable to everybody?
The work in progress numbers suggest that there should be a discernible difference by that October.
So we're told.
So we're told. And it'd be good to see what that actually is.
We'll talk to the agents in the meantime and see what they say. So thank you very much for all that. And thank you for the work.
Before we move on, can I just thank John Holmes and his team for their willingness to adapt, to change, to take on these ideas and lead these ideas.
Absolutely.
And I wish you and your team good luck over the next wee while as we put all this in place. It's a lot of attention and could be a lot of stress, and I don't want stress to be on the team. So it's all good stuff. The team seem very happy to do it. So thank you so much for your openness so far.
Yeah. And I'm sure the committee endorses all of that. And we will look forward to a presentation in October on the general progress that's been made, but particularly on enforcement. And we now move on to Storing Rolls Relics, I think. So this item's the new local plan 2025 to 2045, and it's over to you, Alex, to set us off.
Great, thank you very much, and good evening, everyone. So the purpose of this report is to introduce the new local plan 2025 to 2045. Committee will note that up to this point we've been working on a plan from 2040 around 2045. So this report, which I'm going to give a brief overview for, and then we can go into any questions if there are any, sets out the new requirements for our local plan in terms of the national position. And there's been some not insignificant changes over the last 2 to 3 years that relate to the local plan work, both in terms of the plan context, but also how the plan is prepared. So in terms of the local position, we continue to have an adopted plan, and that plan continues to be used for determining planning applications, decision making. And so in terms of the process, we're driving forward with that local plan as a corporate priority, and we have done reflected on a number of national policy changes recently, as well as public consultation responses that we've had most recently back in the autumn of 2022. So clearly we need to make sure that the local plan is fit for purpose. It's an important process. It's a significant resource for the council to get right, and so that's why there's an awful lot of work has been put into that to make sure that that we are meeting all of our requirements, to make sure that we're delivering the plan that the national policy requires, which is that it's positively prepared, justified, effective, and consistent with the national policy. So, in light of that, I think it's important to just emphasise that because of a significant change in national policy that happened in December, we had to look at the implications of that on our local plan process, and then consider the best way forward. And Cabinet took the decision in March but actually based on the national context, that it was important to use the evidence that we've currently prepared on the local planning policies to date, and then do a significant update on that evidence in order to make sure that we were match fit for what was to come next, which we all want to make sure that we have a local plan in place that gets through the examination process. So turning to national changes, there are
That's page six.
Yes, thank you. So there are a number of elements to this, both legal requirements, policy requirements, and then the evidence base that's required. So first up in terms of the legal requirements is that the Levelling Up and Regeneration Act came into force in October 2023, and that set the stage for some very significant planning reforms to come forward in terms of how local plans are prepared, how quickly they're prepared, and the process of what's required for those local plans. So moving on from that, we then received in December 2024, about a year later, the latest position in terms of the National Planning Policy Framework. However, I think it's important to note that since we went out with the consultation in the autumn of 2022, there have been significant to and froing with national policy, not just around the content of local plans, but also the critical issue around housing numbers and what local authorities should or should not be delivering. So there were consultations, there were updates to national policy. It landed in December 2024 of a new mandatory housing target that every local authority in the country had been given, and that was something that it wasn't in place before, and also the specific number that was given to us. And as I say, I'll go into a little bit more detail in a moment about what that meant for us. So there are other bits of legislation that are now coming forward through the process. In December, at the same time, it was a busy time just before Christmas, we got the English Devolution White Paper that set out how the government wanted to actually devolve powers, functions and responsibilities out of Whitehall and down through the local government system, but also some changes in terms of how local government may want to restructure itself in order to deliver those devolution powers. We're going through that process at the moment in terms of what local authorities want to see for the future to take advantage of those devolution powers and functions, and then the structures that will be used to deliver that. I understand that the English Devolution Bill is currently being written, and it should be laid before Parliament just before recess in the middle of July, but we'll have to wait and see on that. But turning over to page 8, in the meantime, we have had the Planning and Infrastructure Bill that was laid before Parliament in March, and that's currently in process, and that bill is looking at the infrastructure provisions. It's looking at administrations around nature restoration levy, a national scheme of delegation, how planning committees work, as well as environmental outcomes and some elements of delivering national infrastructure. So that bill is significant, but for us, one of the most significant aspects is it introduces strategic planning. And strategic planning we haven't had in this country since 2010 when it was abolished, and so we're now in a position of seeing what that strategic planning will bring, and that will sit over the local plan that we're currently preparing, and so we will not only have to make sure that our new plan is in step citizen, but also the strategic planning context that is emerging. So we promise that that bill will go through the passage of Parliament and should be enacted later in the year. In the meantime, at a policy level, we'll be getting further details in terms of not just how the strategic planning new function will work, but also how the new local plans will be compared within that context. So,
Alex, when will that be?
So we're anticipating that the bill will come into force towards the end of the year, and then there'll be a series of sort of secondary legislation regulations will be coming forward in the spring of next year.
So it's well into next year.
So yeah, so yes. But in the meantime, policy will be national policy will be providing us with a bit more context. So then turning to page 9, probably one of the most significant things that certainly happened in my planning career is that these mandatory housing targets have been provided to us by government, and the implementation of those in terms of planning applications, decision makings, was immediate on the 12th of December, and for plan making it came in March. So the headlines for this was that our number more than doubled on the 12th of December from, as you can see in paragraph 5.23, 358, up to 751. And so that number is amended each year based on affordability ratios, but that is the new number that we now have to address through decision making and also in terms of making the plan. And as a result of that, we found ourselves in a position of losing our 5-year housing land supply. We calculated it based on the number of planning consents that we had available to us at the 31st of March 2024, because each year end, we go out and look at the completions and commitments so that we can then turn the wheel and find out what our position is. And so that work is currently ongoing, and I'm hoping that over the next few weeks we'll be in a position to be able to provide all members with the latest situation on the 5-year land supply as of the 31st of March 2025. So things don't stop, and clearly there are planning applications coming in the door, and those planning applications are now having to be considered first and foremost in the context of the adopted local plan. Okay, so that's really important. The first thing the planning officer will do is look at the adopted local plan and its policies and what it says. The second very quick bit that needs to be looked at very quickly after that is the National Planning Policy Framework, because our plan is more than 5 years out of date, and so therefore, as long as we have a 5-year supply, certain elements of the plan still stand and can be used. One of those elements that fell away in December was the settlement boundaries. And so therefore we are now in a position, because we haven't got a 5-year supply, that planning applications that come forward beyond the settlement boundaries need to be considered firstly in the context of the adopted plan, and secondly in the context of a presumption in favour of sustainable development in the national policy. And what that means is that the bar is set higher regarding whether planning applications can be approved or refused. Bluntly, the principle of development now goes beyond the settlement boundaries. So it's really important that people are aware of that.
Can I ask you, Nicola, does that mean that in fact that what we are getting at the moment with the carte blanche hit anywhere in our territories, etc., of a massive drive for new houses, where in a lot of instances it's not practical to have houses in that area because it cannot be sustained. Does that now mean in actual fact that is not going to happen?
So what that means is clearly there are developers and landowners who know that we haven't got a 5-year supply and will now be putting in or considering putting in planning applications within that new context, i.e. they'll be putting in planning applications beyond the settlement boundaries on green fields, to see how those planning applications fare in the context of the adopted plan and the National Planning Policy Framework. So those planning applications with John and his team will still be considered, as they always have been, on a case-by-case basis. They will be looked at in terms of the principle of where development should or shouldn't happen, but also there's a whole range of other factors, as we all know, there's planning that they will need to consider before then coming to a decision in terms of those planning applications. So it's not a simply opening the floodgates. Those planning applications need to be very carefully considered. They need to be looked at in the context of the settlement hierarchy that we have within the borough, because we've been very clear that we have a sustainable settlement hierarchy of Stafford, Stone and the key service villages because of the infrastructure that we have. So that will continue to be used and looked at when planning applications are considered. And then obviously the officers will then make their decisions, and as appropriate will be coming to planning committee as well. What's something that we need to be mindful of is, and it's always considered, is, you know, if I refuse this application, then what could be the result of that refusal? Is it going to appeal, and then where are we at in terms of appeals? Now the team is still considering and assessing across the country on appeal, very recent appeal decisions of authorities that are in the same position as us, in terms of how those have fared regarding appeals being allowed in spite of, for example, not having the sufficient infrastructure in place for that development to go ahead, like a school or other types of infrastructure. So it's, and that's just an example, but it's important to actually be aware of that and make sure that we're responding to that appropriately. So yeah, that's where we are. That's where we're currently at.
So your question was very much around, if someone's putting forward something that's clearly not sustainable development, is there any protection? And what I'm hearing from you is that it's sustainable development that there is. Sustainable development is the stuff that's likely to happen beyond the settlement boundary. But if it's clearly not sustainable development, if it's clearly not got access to school or communications or whatever, would that be less likely to be successful?
Not necessarily. The thing that needs to be looked at is the definition of sustainable development, which is within that paragraph of the NPPF. And there's a particular footnote as well that says, you know, it wouldn't be sustainable if it was in a national landscape or national park, or if it's an irreplaceable asset. So there's a whole list of things that we have within our borough where it says development here would not be, you know, sustainable, would not be appropriate in terms of national policy.
As long as common sense can be still used. So I'll go along with that. But
we have to work within the national policy context that we've now been given. And I think it's fair to say that we've been very late to the party on this one, very late to the party, because of the strength of our adopted plan. We've actually had a 5-year supply for quite a long time. There are other authorities across the country who have been in this position for 3, 4, 5 years plus. And so therefore that's why the appeals and the number of cases that have gone through is now not, you know, so significant, the number, because an awful lot of authorities across the country, including some of our close neighbours, have been in this position for some time. So what we're now doing is, because of that, progressing with the existing local plan just wasn't an option to move forward on for two reasons. Firstly, that we weren't match fit for examination in terms of the plan that we had prepared, so we need to look at how much more work did we need to do to get to a position where we could go to examination and be really confident that that plan could get through, and how long would it take? So how long would it take and how much resource would it take to get it over the line? And we came to the conclusion, which we presented to Cabinet, that the length of time that we would take to get the evidence in place, even before these new numbers, to get over the line by the target that the government had given us was not enough. We didn't have enough time to cover the ground. So that's why the decision was made. Right, we've got these new doubling of numbers. That completely changes the context of what the development strategy will be for the local plan. And so therefore we need to really get to grips with this evidence base now, and actually put the resources in to know. We know the housing figure, we now need to know what the employment number is going to be that relates to that, and the associated infrastructure, etc., etc. And so that's why we've published a new local plan timetable that sets out a realistic approach as we know it so far to what we can achieve, and with great thanks to the council for actually providing us with that resource back in February to actually crack on and get this evidence based done, which is what the team are doing, exactly what the team are doing now. We're conscious that developers, landowners and local residents are aware of our new situation, and they're talking to members and they're talking to us as well, and so that's why I very much would like to share some further details with all members of the council in the coming weeks, once we've got the most up-to-date information available through the year-end monitoring work that's currently being finalised.
So I'm going to allow Councillor Nixon to come in, but just in terms of that, Alex, the vulnerability for this authority is going to be there for the next 2-3 years, presumably.
It's not possible to put a time scale on it. Because it
will be there as long as it takes us to produce a local plan, presumably.
No, it depends on how many planning applications are given consent.
Between now and then.
And so the more planning applications for housing, for new housing that get consent, ideally across a range of different site sizes,
yep.
Because different sites, as you know, are built out at different rates. And so, therefore, that would have an impact. But the more sites that we have with consent, and the quicker that those can be built out, the better position we will be, the quicker we will be in a position to be able to get back our 5-year supply and then reapply those second benefits.
And that will be moving towards the 826.
But bear in mind, as the report says, it becomes a 6-year supply at a certain point as well.
So you have to speak up, sorry.
It becomes a 6-year supply at a certain point as well. So remember, we're catching up.
Yes,
and then
exactly.
We have to exceed that catch-up.
Yeah, exactly.
To stay.
Yeah, so we've got a worrying time. I'll let Councillor Nixon come in.
Thank you, Chair. You were talking about sustainability, and I've got 4 points to raise on that, if I may. Firstly, infrastructure. We absolutely and definitely do not have the infrastructure we currently need, let alone putting more houses on. We absolutely don't, and that needs to be sorted out first before we have an influx of people. Secondly, we currently have no empty homes officer. That's really important, and that needs to be kept an eye on. Thirdly, we need to make sure we can employ people. What are all these people going to be doing for work? That's significant. And lastly, flooding. We're building and building and building. We've already got a flooding issue. This needs to be addressed before we continue to build, because we're going to be getting in a mess, and please, we need to stop and plan appropriately. Thank you.
We take those points on board. I think
yes,
we'd all agree with those.
And I particularly highlight the points about employment, so the piece of piece of work that we're about to commission, which is looking at the updates of the economic and housing development needs assessment, will address exactly those points around economically active people and making sure that we've got sufficient economic growth and employment now and identifying on the plan to actually meet the needs of communities moving forward. And on page 16 there's a very brief overview of the evidence-based work that we're going to be doing this financial year and next financial year.
Yep.
For brevity, I've put SFRA, but that's a strategic readiness assessment, that's what it stands for. And so that piece of work will be a central piece of work that we will roll forward. We've already got a relatively up-to-date flood risk assessment that's on our website, but we need to make sure that it's absolutely up-to-date, working with our colleagues in the Environment Agency. And so that piece of work will be looked at next year.
Any other points that you want to pick up there?
Councillor Winnington
wants to speak on the items that so far.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
It's quite a deep question, but as we go through local government, this organisation, obviously the planning will move to a different level. How can we ensure that the footprint of Stafford Borough Council is maintained so that we don't get another two or three thousand houses a year foisted upon Stafford Borough? Will we be able to put this into the new local plan, and how long will that last for?
Can you answer that, Alex? It's meeting local need as against incoming residents.
So I can answer it in generality but not in detail, because the details are still being prepared at the moment by government, because the government is going to be issuing policy updates in terms of strategic planning, and that will set the scene for what the housing and employment needs will be required that sit above the local plan level in due course through what they've called the spatial development strategies that will be prepared by the strategic authorities. And so I can't answer the implications of that new document and the decisions that it will be making, because that's a process that will be taking place during the course of next year and the year after. What I can say is that in terms of producing a spatial development strategy, there will need to be an awful lot of evidence and information that is drawn up from our level in order to inform that decision making, because decision making at a strategic level can't be made in a vacuum. It needs to look at the local context and any evidence, because that would have to go through an examination process in order to be ratified. And so therefore the fact that we are on the front step right now doing that piece of evidence-based work this year means that we can then be in a very strong position to influence those decisions based on some really up-to-date evidence that we're going to be putting in place and making available through that process. So forgive me, there's not much more that I can say about that until we get more detail, but I'd very much like to come back to the committee later in the year or in the spring when we've got that information to be able to share it with you.
And when do you think it will come out?
I suspect that we're probably looking at towards the end of this year, that when the Planning and Infrastructure Bill will be enacted, but we're promised that the NDPF with the new National Development Management Policies will be published in the summer. And also some more details about what the new local plan process will be and what the strategic process will be that sit above it. So I anticipate that we should be able to come back or towards the end of the year with those details.
Right. That's very helpful. Does that make sense that we bring Alex back in probably in November, wouldn't it? October, actually, our meetings.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll put it in, we'll give you a slot in October if we've got the information from government. But it all seems to be lagging badly, as far as I can see. So we'll allow you to delay if nothing has come through.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to add on this, Alex?
No,
you've talked about the evidence base and the appendix. Thank you very much. Anybody got any last questions of Alex?
Can I just ask one last one? One of the biggest problems in my particular area at the moment, in fact, when there's any building being proposed, etc., is the water supply. still in the throes of the sort of ancients who built them in the first place, so we're going back to God Saxon times, I think. And forever we're getting floods, breaking down, etc., of water supply systems into brand new housing estates, etc. What, in actual fact, is your intentions of being able to stop this particular problem?
So there are two elements to that. Well, with water you've got clean and dirty water, which are two separate systems. And we work very closely with Severn Trent through the plan making process. So when we're looking at proposed allocations, we make them aware very early about the sites that we're looking at and ask them directly what are the implications on the sewage system and the clean water system on this development. Is there capacity? If not, and we go ahead, then what can be done in order to make sure that that scheme is appropriate? Because we don't want to include anything in the local plan that's going to make sure that the system creaks beyond measure. So that's what we do in terms of the plan making process. But in the meantime, with individual planning applications, which is what we're going to faced with at the moment, there is that statutory paucity requirement for the utilities to engage, of which Severn Trent Water is one, but there are others in terms of electricity, gas, etc., who are consulted through the development management process. So all of that information is very carefully looked at as we look at both aspects.
Thank you. And actually, one of the things we've been asked to do as a result of council about two meetings ago, maybe more, was to look at the protection of our rivers and oceans. So our next meeting would be a very good appropriate moment to look at that and perhaps incorporate the points that you've been making there, Alex, about how we deal with strategic planning and how we deal with actual applications. Would that be agreeable with everyone?
July, is it not here?
Sorry?
Yeah.
Is it not mentioned that phase 25 is being in July?
Yeah. Is it? Oh, we've got it down already. Yeah. Yep, sorry.
But just on that, I do encourage councillors, and maybe your parish council as well, if you know there are issues with Severn Trent's infrastructure in certain areas, write to Severn Trent, get the parish council to write to them, to have them publicly explain back if they feel that it is unsustainable development, if more houses should be there. Get them to make an opinion on that so that they can say, in order to support more houses, we would need infrastructure. Getting that knowledge ahead of time really helps with the plan making, and really helps, if there's evidence there, really helps the planning officers as well. It turns rumour and experience into something more solid. So write to them, get them to come talk to your parish council or whatever, and engage them early. Because if it's solvable, they'll tell you what it takes to solve it, that might scare developers off. And if it's not solvable, then that's not positive to that.
Anything else on Alex's very monumental topic? If not, thanks very much, Alex, for that contribution. And we now move on to the next item.
Can we just reinforce July 14th is the date, I believe? But
yeah, I'm coming back to that at the end of the meeting anyway. And so we now move on to Michelle.
page 17, Chair.
I've got it, UKS.
That's it.
This is a sort of factual presentation, isn't it, Michelle, of a success story,
it's
we
hope.
It's a
retrospective of a huge success.
Excellent. We like that.
So this is to update members on the completed programme for UK Shared Prosperity Fund projects that have been in place for the last 3 years, with a slight caveat that the programme has been extended for a further 12 months. So now that we've finished off last year's, we're just in the process of getting 2025 six projects underway, so we will be coming back to members to go into a bit more detail about the work we're doing over the next 12 months. Do you want me to take the report page by page, because I can then basically run you through the various projects?
Yeah, why not?
Projects. Okay. So, just in section 5 on page 17, it talks about the amount of money that was allocated, which was just over £4.5 million to cover the financial years 2022 to 2025, but I think the first tranche of money was received with about 4 months to go in that first year, so it's been delivered over a period of less than 2.5 years. The vast majority of the money that was allocated to the council was for revenue funding, which, unless you're a finance person, doesn't mean a huge amount sometimes. So some projects that are capital can only be funded if we can demonstrate that we've added capital value to something, basically, whereas with revenue funding it can cover a whole host of things, from gardening implements for local communities to be able to manage a community garden, right the way through to thousands of pounds worth of business grants. So the revenue side of things is where the bulk of the activity lay, but we did have some capital projects within there as well. Also, because of Stafford's geography, we were also entitled to a further £487,000 of Rural England Prosperity Fund. Not all councils got that, so across Staffordshire there was a very small number that actually qualified for that. Just down the road, Cannock didn't qualify for that. And basically that was a wholly capital allocation that was specifically for investment in rural areas, but rural areas as determined by DEFRA, which causes some fun and games, because some places that we would think were rural weren't, and some places we thought weren't rural were, that we went with it. And the headline is that all of the money that we were allocated was spent on time. So turning on to page 18, basically the UK Shared Prosperity Fund is probably the most flexible funding stream that the council have been allocated in a very long time. And effectively, there were some caveats around what we could spend money on, and there were some caveats on the kinds of things we needed to demonstrate when we were spending the money. But over and above that, it was very much left up to the Borough Council as the funding body, plus local partners, to determine the best use of the funds. As long as we met the kind of themes of investment that the government were looking for. So first of all, under the community in place theme, we have 9 projects over the course of the programme that ranged from investment in Eccleshall Tennis Club, where they installed an artificial grass court, solar panels on Stone Leisure Centre, Cranmore Theatre in Stone, where basically they had been fundraising for the kit to be able to actually open the theatre, so that's what we kind of assisted with there. Some of the money, some of the capital, went towards the acquisition of the co-op building as part of the Stafford Town Centre transformation. But then the other end of the scale with the town centre, we also invested in some new Christmas lights. Something that you kind of need to have a rolling programme of funding to make sure you're keeping everything moving. The Staffordshire History Centre that the County Council opened a few months ago now. Was it this year?
Yes, this year.
It was this year, wasn't it? We invested, again, another capital contribution into that project, which was, again, an absolute patchwork of funding. So a huge amount from the Heritage Lottery Fund, but the the various volunteer groups and friends of associated with William Salt Library. There was funding coming from there and the County Council as well, so again a partnership approach to investment, and they are doing incredibly well, visitor numbers in the thousands within a very few months. Then back to a smaller scale project, we had some renovations to Stone's Scout Hut. I think this one relating to the floor, which was in quite a dilapidated condition, so it basically means that that community can carry on being used and don't fall through into whatever's underneath the Scout Hut. Similarly, Westbridge Park, so you all know about the project for the actual the play area. Alongside that, the UK Shared Prosperity Fund money was used to basically add value to that original park project by looking at the car parks for the canoe club and again for the scouts. So basically, something that became a key kind of theme was it doesn't have to be a brand new project if we can add value to something that's already being delivered, so that effectively you're getting more out of your investment, and that's what we tried to do. And then finally, the visitor promotion campaign, so the Our Beautiful Borough website, which exists purely because we had funding via COVID grants to the council going back, 5 years now, and basically when the COVID grants ran out, we looked at the impact that that website had in terms of generating interest in and visits to not just Stafford but Stafford Borough, and that was worth additional investment, so that's basically what's kept the wheels turning on that website. Before I go on to the business theme, is there anything anyone wanted to pick up on any of those projects?
If one goes to Drunken Gardens, have to wander through there, etc., they have a fantastic way of actually advertising to all the people that go there what's actually happening all the time, and then you can't miss it. Therefore, you can't lose the spirit for them to go back again. Has there any thought of doing a similar sort of thing in Stafford?
At which particular venue are you thinking?
On the main streets where.
So that's what the Our Beautiful Borough website does. So it's not just the website, it's across social media channels where basically it advertises businesses, visitor attractions and events. So all of the reasons for people to come is pushing those messages out.
Okay.
Do we include Trentham as part of that, seeing they are in the book?
We absolutely do.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. So, moving on to the business support programme. Although there's only 6 items listed here, this is a huge area of activity, and I know Martine's come and spoken to members before about the various business support programmes that we had in place, and this does make it sound as though it's a little bit more straightforward than it was, but basically the business support programme looked at a range of grant schemes available to businesses. That this wasn't one grant scheme that we just kept running. It was adapting to what we were hearing from the local businesses. So we would have policy that said, if you're this type of business doing this type of thing and this is how you want to make some investment, we'll help you with it. But then naturally we get applications for things that sit outside of the policy. And again, that flexibility that the UKSPF scheme gave us meant that we could then look at the criteria within the various policy documents and make sure that as many people as possible, as many businesses as possible, were benefiting. Again, the overall ethos of this scheme was to spend the money. So we stood up at an event in January at the Post House and said, We're not saying apply for this and we'll find reasons not to give you the money. It was very much, we've got this money, we want the local businesses to benefit, work with us, and it went extremely well. So there's a number of programmes mentioned in there, but the highlight figure is that 125 businesses across the borough benefited from that support programme. Similar but different, we then had the Green Solutions programme, which included both training and a grant scheme, which is basically helping businesses, I don't like this phrase but I can't think of a better one, on their journey to net zero, and basically showing them the things they can practically do but not a kind of blanket approach. So understanding what smaller businesses are able to meaningfully implement to help them, and as a byproduct of that, also things that actually save their businesses money. So it's not just a case of ticking a box to say I'm green because I do X, Y, and Z. It could be something that genuinely reduces their energy costs, for example, which is a kind of win-win. Moving on to High Street, so we have the capital investment in the co-op, and we also have the investment in the lighting, but this then specifically focused on businesses operating within the High Streets of Stafford Stone and Eccleshaw. Basically, this scheme was born out of some workshops that had been run as part of the wider business support programme, and we could target this to businesses that we knew could turn around their investment quite quickly. Probably one of the only, it's not a negative, but it was a bit of a constraint to the UK SPF scheme, was that we had an extremely hard deadline of the 31st of March, so money had to have been spent either by a community group or a business, and they needed to be able to demonstrate what they've done with that money. And this was a relatively late launch scheme because it was basically picking up where other projects had come in under budget. We needed to get some money spent. This was brilliant because it was businesses saying, we're more than willing to do this, just give us a bit of help to get there on time. And we did. Specific focus on rural business and innovation in business, really successful. These are what we called the big and the big two, a range of grants that 52 businesses benefited from, which is a huge amount when you consider the amount of information that each of them had to provide to demonstrate that they were going to be meeting the objectives of the funding. And we've got some great case studies coming out of all of these business support programmes that kind of give a bit of flavour. So we can give you statistics, but that kind of tells you on a day-to-day basis how things have improved for these various businesses.
It was a range of businesses, wasn't it?
It was a huge range. And what we tried to do was make sure that where there was demand for a grant, that we were able to meet it. A piece of work that we carried out more in, I think this was the 2022 one, so it's a little while ago now, was basically around a feasibility for a rural workspace. So this was something that had been talked about at length just before the UK SPF scheme had been launched. So with the ability to actually get some data and look into it, that piece of work was done. Unfortunately, the outcome was that actually there's lots and lots of different things that make it really quite difficult in the time we've got funding for to be able to progress that project any further. So whilst we could have done another piece of work looking at that in greater detail, we knew that the outcome was still going to be actually this is really difficult, and that's where we then reallocated some of that money back into the other projects. So I think it was to demonstrate we wanted to understand what the art of the possible was. That's the answer that we got. And then finally, under this strand, we invested into the Institute of Technology that is soon to open within the Gateway site in Stafford. So fantastic project for Stafford, and the college are a brilliant partner to work with. And this hits so many of the objectives of the UK SPF scheme. We were really pleased to be able to help them with their development. So that's business. Any questions on that one before I move on to the rural strand? Okay, so the REP, so this is the Rural England Prosperity Fund, the additional chunk of funding that we've got. So you can see we've got Foreton, Stone, Ranton, Broughton. This is obviously on a smaller scale, but basically these were all specifically rural community projects that benefited here. I think you hear a lot about the business side of investment, but actually these projects, each in their own right, have a huge impact locally, which again, is part of the point of the funding scheme. So that just leaves us, if there aren't any other questions, just to recap that we have now launched working on the 25-6 programme of projects. So I think by the time we come back, maybe not in July, it'll probably be the meeting after that, we can give you a bit more of a detailed run through of the projects that are up and running there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any more questions?
Is there a process that someone like a village hall can approach you to with the project?
Yeah, so what we have to do, when the funding was launched, we already have had to make a submission to government to say, broadly speaking, this is where our investment is going in this financial year. Within what we've tried to do is keep that as broad as possible. Where there are elements that either community groups or businesses can bid into, as each strand is launched, we will publicise that to make it known as widely as we can where there's eligibility. What we can't do is kind of say, we've got an open book here for any project, because it doesn't quite work that way because of the criteria that we have to hit with the funding. But yeah, we're really lucky because Will does an awful lot of press release work with us to make sure that we're reaching the right people.
Thank you. Just on that specific point, every now and then we do leaflets to support this, explain it, and you'll find them in your pigeonholes. Please do take those to your community groups, to your local businesses. Do use them to talk to them about what they can get. And even if they're not available now, the contact details on it will be excellent for them to get in touch with the team about anything they need in the future. So do use those leaflets. Don't just pile them back on the side. Go distribute them to your local businesses and community groups.
Thank you. Dean?
Thanks, Chair. I hope you don't mind. I think it's important to note the really hard work that's gone on here, Michelle, Martin, the team. We received £4.673 million, a really big sum of money, and we managed to spend every penny, and that has meant that we have a full allocation of UKSPF for the 25-26 year, which is around about £1.5 million.
Just about, yeah.
Yep. So we were able to fund further projects this year, and we will be coming back to Cabinet with detail on those projects, and as Michelle said, we can share that with the committee. But a lot of hard work, Michelle and the team, finance colleagues, and others really have contributed. Obviously, members have helped us to do that. But it's a really big achievement, and I don't mind you saying that. But we are excited to have a third allocation of monies and come back with more projects for this year. We don't know if we will have any more money beyond March 2026. We'll see what happens in, obviously there are spending reviews, I'm not going to comment on that, but UKSPF has been a really good fund, it's been really flexible, and we've been able to fund a variety of different projects, whether it's community projects, business and institute technology. So we've been really motivated by this, we've really enjoyed administering the fund and spending the money on really good projects, and hopefully we can get more of that in the future rather than more bidding and more competitive processes. This has been money allocated to the area with us to develop a plan and then deliver the project. So I think thank you, but we would like more of these kind of funds going forward. I think that would be our sort of message. That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dean, and we hope you'll be looking out for them at every turn. But thank you, Michelle, and will you pass on our thanks to Martine? I know how much work she's done as well,
yeah.
And it's a tremendous success story, as I said when I introduced it. Anybody else got any comments on that? We'll wait and see what comes next. Which moves us on to our work programme. Now, we've already got the Rivers and Oceans motion in July on our list. Now, we've got business planning report. That has just been circulated by N. Curran to, I think, all members. I presume it's gone out to all members. It's gone as a, this year, it goes to council, and usually there's a separate report from every scrutiny committee, but for some reason they've decided to bung the whole lot into one short report, which isn't good enough, to be honest. And and the detail that's included from this committee is woeful. And so when we pick it up in July, which we will, we'll need to rewrite it, and between now and then you'll have sight of what has actually been put in as a draft. And we will include all the other things that we've done over the last 12 months to take to the council meeting. So that was one item that's on there, as well as the rivers and oceans. Now, moving to Charlotte Kane, we were very keen to include in our July meeting. Her role has changed. Would you like to explain that, Dean? Because it's interesting to have her talk about her new role.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And Michelle, correct me if I get this one wrong, but I think Charlotte's role has now expanded to cover investment, not just tourism, visit economy, but inward investment. I think it's called Staffordshire Investment Agency.
Yes.
It's a new organisation,
yeah,
working across the county, promoting the county as an investment location, working with districts and boroughs. Charlotte is currently recruiting to roles within the team. And I think, Chair, it would be useful as part of her presentation to kind of talk about what the investment agency is about, what its objectives are. As I say, it isn't just tourism, there are a number of different strands. So we'd be more than happy to go back to Charlotte and kind of extend that wider invitation to her for the July meeting. Is there anything, Michelle, I've missed?
No.
Is everyone happy with that? So in other words, we pick up everything that she's doing now, not just the tourism side, which I think would be very, very interesting. And in particular in relation to the borough, of course, as well as the county. So that would be our July programme. Does anybody have any burning items that should come onto that programme? Nope. In that case, I'm going to move to October, where we have already said during the meeting that we would look at enforcement. And an update from Alex on the work that's going on there, an update from Michelle on the UK SPF. It looks like October at the moment is a number of updates, with the Gateway likewise. Is that a good timing for the Gateway? We've got Section 106 has been, we've been dealing with, and it'd be interesting to have a consideration of what's happening there. And then the other one, which is very topical with members, is this business of solar farms. And I would very much like to put that onto the agenda for the October meeting. Does that sound okay to two members?
Mm-hmm.
It'd be quite a lot of different items rather than July, which is a couple of very substantive items. Which takes us into February, where we could pick up the historic buildings and the master plan. Is that February a good time, Greg, for the master plan?
Yeah.
Sorry, Chair, that meeting's actually December, not February.
Oh, I've missed out a December meeting.
18th of December.
Yeah, December, sorry.
Yeah.
To what in December, Chairman?
18th December.
What's going on in
the December? That would be the master plan. And the historic buildings as well can come into that. Is there anything else? That takes us to the end of the year rather than into February. So I think that sort of keeps us going for quite a while, doesn't it? There are a number of actions which Jim is going to point out in the minute, so that we don't just have that we accepted a report. We'll be asking, where it's appropriate, we'll be asking Cabinet to pick items up and take things forward that we've discussed tonight. Has anybody got anything else? Any? No? Well, thank you very much, Bill. Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
because it's my first time I've attended this meeting, I'd like to congratulate the officers and the excellent way they gave us the report. It's been very interesting.
Absolutely. Thank you very much to all of them. Has Alex gone? No, Alex is there. Thank you, Dina, and thanks to Lucy as well. And I declare the meeting closed. Thank you. Thank you.